Burton Blatt, Dean of the College of Education and Centennial Professor of Special Education and Rehabilitation at Syracuse University, is our guest in this week's edition of the University of Iowa Radio Forum. Professor Paul Reddish of the University of Iowa Division of Special Education talked with Dean Blatt during his recent time at the university as an Ida Beam visiting professor.
Dean Blatt, we're happy to have you with us, and I'd like to explore a little bit about how you entered into the field of special education. I found a quote in one of your books that talks a little bit about the movement you've had in advocacy. And this is from the book The Revolt of the Idiots, 1981. And it says, one of the characters who is a special needs person says, it means we are human beings. It means we have to fight for those rights because other people alone can't fight for us. And you go on to talk about how special needs people have to fight for themselves, as well as professionals have to fight for the rights of special needs people. I wonder if you can give us some historical points to this, as how you've come to these sorts of realizations.
Well, the entrance into the field came about in the late 40s. I was an English teacher in New York City, and the coach of the school's basketball team. One of the members of the team was Louis Gossett Jr., who just received the Oscar for his portrayal in one of these movies. But also on the team were who I later found out to be boys from the special class. Not Louis, of course. Louis was a very bright student. And I got interested in them. Here were young fellows who were very competent athletes whose problem-solving abilities out of school were not only adequate, but in some sense superior. They were school heroes. But in school, their capability was marginal at best, deemed by the school psychologist to be mildly mentally retarded. Well, the more I looked into that work, the more interested I became, and just by chance, I taught in a school with some very gifted people, special educators. Hank Mann, who's now at Buffalo State, a few others, got involved in developing programs for the mentally retarded in New York under the aegis of Richard Hungerford, who was then the director of special education for the city, the largest special education program in the world then, probably to this day. And before I realized what was happening, I had shifted my professional interest from English to special education. Now, this quote in that easily forgotten novel, Revolt of the Idiots, which I wrote a few years ago, exemplifies something I learned from the women's movement and the Black Revolution and the other minority movements, that it wasn't until the women themselves and the Blacks themselves and the Chicanos themselves said, wait, it isn't that I'm different, it's that we are a group who are different. And not only must we change in certain ways, but you, the larger society, must change. That it wasn't until the women took their lives in their own hands that we actually had a women's revolution. It was a stunning revolution, achieved so much in a decade. 10-15 years ago, people made jokes about women's equality. Women themselves made jokes about women's equality. Very few people tell jokes that way anymore. So I come back again and again to this idea that while it's easier for a bright woman to advocate for herself, or black, or Chicano, or Native American, a person who's called mentally retarded, how as hard as it may be, must do that. And you know, there have been movements now led by the mentally retarded, right along these lines.
Such as People's First.
People's First. Truth isn't only stranger than fiction, but fiction sometimes precedes truth.
Yeah. An interesting point you make. I hear much in my own work, since we are both in similar fields, of the great anger many of the special needs people have about such things as the Jerry Lewis telethon.
Mm-hmm.
That's been a tremendously enlightening experience for myself. Do you get the same feelings about?
Oh, yes, I worry greatly about Jerry Lewis's telethon. I don't discount his public service, his good intentions, but they're not Jerry's kids. And this idea of charity for these people is very repugnant. We have on our campus a muscular dystrophy telethon. And dance, marathon. And it's very ironic that these healthy university students spend 24, 30, 35 hours, however long it takes for the last couple to survive, on a dance marathon for people who are in wheelchairs. To give charity to people in wheelchairs, university students dance till they drop. There's got to be a better way to not only raise funds to give proper supports to the needs these people have, but also to communicate the humanity of these people and their needs as human beings.
Yeah, I'd like to tie that in. I have had similar arguments on this campus. We have groups who roll an empty keg of beer between Iowa City and Dubuque or something like this to raise money, and you pay them for every mile. And it seems to me it's the same thing as the point of trying to get people to speak for themselves, or in terms of society taking the easy way out in terms of delivering services. I want to go back in terms of your own history. In a book that I read that tremendously impressed me because of my own work as a teenager, I worked at a place called Willowbrook. And you know and I know that back in the 40s and the 50s, and in the 50s is when I worked there, that was a horrible place for any human being, no less somebody who was a special needs person. And you did a photographic essay called Christmas in Purgatory, which I think took the special education world and even the non-special education world right back on their heels, including the bureaucracy who were paying for this. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about how that came about, and then how that affected you in terms of your dealing with bureaucracy at every level.
Well, Paul, of course, that's a long story. I'll try to make it as short as I possibly can. I wrote about that part of my life in a couple of subsequent books, Exodus from Pandemonium and Souls and Extremis, but let's see if I can recount some of it. It was 1965, and Bobby Kennedy was running for the Senate of New York, and I was involved in the field of mental retardation deeply, also involved somewhat with the Kennedy Foundation, and worked with Mrs. Shriver and Mr. Shriver. And so both because of my interest in the field and interest in the Kennedys, I had been following Mr. Kennedy's trips to Willowbrook, Wassaic, Rome, and Letchworth. These are state schools for the mentally retarded in New York. And he made the front page of the Times for several days, decrying the conditions in those schools. Well, I remember one day I was at a regional meeting of the American Association on Mental Deficiency. Had read the Morning Times story about Mr. Kennedy's visits to those institutions. And I was the dinner speaker at the AAMD conference. And I spoke about his visits, deviating from my previously prepared remarks for that evening. And I asked the audience, all of whom knew about our institutional problems, many of whom were superintendents themselves of institutions or people in rather high positions in the institutions. And I asked them if they didn't think it's time we did something about those problems. Well, after the dinner, I was having some coffee with some friends, two of whom were former presidents of AAMD, who castigated me pretty severely for the speech I had made, told me that, well, Mr. Kennedy is no more than a politician, that it's in the nature of severe mental retardation for people to exist in the ways which he described them. While it's well known that the backwards of institutions are populated by naked, assaultive, incontinent people milling about with nothing to do, that it's in the nature of the condition which requires cruel treatment. Not that we are cruel people, but that we must seclude, we must restrain, we must punish, otherwise we could not contain these monsters. And the more I discussed this matter with my friends, the more I realized that here is the quintessential example of the naked emperor. That everybody knows something that no one is talking about. Well, just a couple of weeks later, we had Thanksgiving, and the annual Thanksgiving dinner was shared with good friends of ours who then were neighbors, Fred Kaplan and his wife and family. He is a very well-known photographer, mainly sports photographs, pictures on the covers of those sports magazines. And I asked him if he would travel around with me to some institutions, because I wanted to document what I knew was there. I had known about those situations, but had thought differently about them until recent months. But I said to him, we're not going to be invited in to take pictures, Fred, so I'm going to secure invitations, and you are to take pictures with a concealed camera. He found no difficulty in accomplishing that, having been not only experienced, but for many years a news photographer who took pictures in the most inappropriate ways and places. Well, we got our story. I wrote the story and took Fred's possibly 10,000 pictures which he had taken. I gathered together 100 or so, and wrote a story about around Christmas time after visiting these five institutions, wrote the story in a week, put together the pictures. It led to an article in Look magazine, which was then a very important publication. The article evoked over 10,000 letters, and from what they tell me, more mail than any article in the history of Look. We published a first edition of the book ourselves, Southeastern Connecticut Parent Association for the Retarded, gave me a couple of $1,000, which permitted me to publish 1,000 copies of the book. We sent it to every governor of the United States, president of the United States, who called me, President Johnson at the time, called me for several more copies, personally. Every mental health commissioner, mental retardation commissioner, many professors of special ed. We sent out the 1,000 copies. I kept one copy for myself, which I still have. And Allen and Bacon said they'd like to publish the book, although they knew they wouldn't sell it. But they'd been wanting me to write other books for them, and they thought this might encourage me to write other books for them. So they published a small printing. I assigned all royalties for that and subsequent printings to that ARC that gave us the original money. They didn't ask for it, but I want them to do that. And Fred did too. Alan Bacon eventually published 11 or 12 or 15 printings. It was sold in the thousands and thousands and thousands of copies. It's still in print. Human Policy Press, 16 or 17 years later, still sells copies of Christmas in Purgatory. There are a few people who think it might have had something to do with the impetus to deinstitutionalize mentally retarded.
Do you think the point you were trying to make in Christmas in Purgatory is still pertinent in 1983?
Sure. 15 years later, or maybe a dozen years later, we went back to those same institutions and others that had been created to respond to the anguish and the reform-mindedness of the people. And we published a book, The Family Papers, just a couple of years ago, published by Longman, which tried to address that question. What's changed? Well, everything has changed and nothing has changed. The institutions are smaller, more heavily staffed. The residents now wear clothes. There's very little seclusion. There's not anywhere near as much restraint. There are therapy programs and treatment programs. More of the mildly retarded around the community. But for those in the institution, while they're dressed, while they have more therapists, they're still segregated, and there's still nothing to do. So you go into a day room, which now has been, quote, normalized, which is a non sequitur, a contradiction in terms, the day room of the institution normalized. There's a rug in the day room where there was a tile or terrazzo floor. There are nice furniture. There are more attendants. And there's a school. And we did Christmas in Purgatory. Most of the retarded children did not go to school, even though they were at the state school. At Willowbrook, there were 6,000 residents at the time when you worked there.
That's right.
Might have been 4,000 or 5,000 people of school age there. 400 went to school. Well, now Willowbrook, there are maybe 1,000, maybe 750 residents, and the children all have schooling, and the adults even have programs. More than they had. It's much more expensive now. Things are a lot better there now. But essentially, they're segregated and there's nothing to do. So everything has changed and nothing has changed.
Well, I view you as an optimist. I mean, when I look at you and I look at your writings, and you and I have talked over the more than number of years I'd like to count that we've known each other, I always view you as an optimist.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, you talk in very pessimistic terms in the sense that 15, 18 years old, this great enlightenment happened to the public. We went out, the public who had nothing to do with it, went out and bought these books. And I, by the way, know for a fact from personal experience and from viewing the books, the pictures are not pretty pictures. They're not soft pictures that make you want to sit down and just feel good watching them. So the brutality comes through. And yet there is brutality, although of a different nature in 1983. There's more of a depersonalization, dehumanizing. We've satisfied our outright guilty consciences. Are you still an optimist? Are you becoming a pessimist? What do you see today and tomorrow?
Well, let's handle one question at a time. Personally, I am an optimist. I always will be. And the way I'm able to handle the lack of progress I seek is that everything I do for myself. In this sense, there's something in the Old Testament which says, before you try to change the world, change yourself. I'm changing myself. I'm doing what I think is right. I'm trying to accomplish what I think needs accomplishing. Whether the world changes, whether my points are made, whether the society understands what I want them to understand, is not going to quell the optimism because I'm changing. Now, looking at the term optimism and pessimism more conventionally, I'm optimistic, even though the progress hasn't been as great as I wish, even though I worry about the dark clouds in the future. I'm optimistic because we seem to be owning the language more than the segregators and institutionalizers. You can't meet anybody who isn't for normalization. Now, of course, the term has been bastardized so that the institutionalizers say we normalize in the institution. But nobody's against normalization. Nobody's against deinstitutionalization. So we own the conception of what human beings need. 20 years ago, the conception of what mentally retarded people need was the institution. Today, even the institutionalizers say, this is not the way we want it. This is necessary. Well, I disagree with them about that. But at least now they understand or say that the institution is merely necessary, not desirable. We made a lot of progress. It's a matter of time. Those who own the language own everything, the ideology. And once you own the language, you own the ideology, and once you own the ideology, it's just a matter of time before that ideology will be realized in some observable way.
I understand what you're saying, and yet I have in my own mind a great concern of some of the dark clouds that you mentioned. I wonder if, as we come to sort of an end point of this, we could talk about the today and the close future. That is, there are tremendous political decisions being made that affect human services right now. And from my perspective, I have some concerns about them, from our national policies to even state and local policies. I worry whether, because economics is so tight, would the society start thinking about putting special people back into segregated classes or institutions because the feeling is that it's cheaper? What do you see happening, and what do you see in the near future changes occurring? And as usual, my 4 or 5 questions at once. Do we as professionals and people who are interested have any place to intervene?
Well, sure, I'm worried. I'm worried about a government that once tried to convince us that ketchup was a vegetable or that old people on Social Security should pay income tax on their Social Security. I worry about a government that's bent on spending a great deal more for making war than for healing bodies. And the future is cloudy. The economy is not stable. If it gets very much worse, there is going to be a removal of supports for community programs for the mentally retarded and others, as there already has been in New York State. And there is a possibility that we could begin again to warehouse people and stuff them in institutions. We're warehousing older people and stuffing them in institutions.
And calling them, in your speech that we just came from, I love the name of one place that you found called something like Camelot.
Yes. I worry about all of these things, Paul. But as of the moment, the deinstitutionalizers, the desegregators, those who want to return to all people opportunities to live, to grow, to enjoy this land, they do, we do, own the language. We seem, at least for the moment, to have convinced America that it could be a more decent society. And I'm optimistic that we'll continue in that direction. Although, for sure, there are worries.
Since this is since we're running out of time, since this is a university community, what's the general posture of the university, or what should it be as a dean? What do you see as the general posture we should have regarding these threats and these possible changes? Should we be advocates at a university situation, or should we be in our offices doing our research, if that's diametrically opposed?
Well, the university is always accused of ivory towerism. I don't think that's usually true. On your own campus, you have not only a great medical school, but it's a great medical school because you have great referral hospitals. People from all over the state come here for treatment. And your School of Education must have that same kind of conception of its purpose. Great training requires great attention to the needs of people in your professional schools. While much of what we learn in the university is for its own sake, there eventually is in everything we learn this idea that there will be a benefit to society. Even the pure mathematician who's dreaming about new theorems eventually is thinking about some way that new theorem is going to benefit society with a different structure or a different understanding. So the university is intimately and forever connected with the larger world. It must be, especially in our field.
Thank you, Dean Blatt. It was very good, very interesting.
Burton Blatt is Dean of the College of Education and Centennial Professor of Special Education and Rehabilitation at Syracuse University. Paul Reddish is Professor of Special Education at the University of Iowa. Their conversation was recorded for this week's edition of the University of Iowa Radio Forum during Dean Blatt's recent time at the university as an Ida Beam visiting professor.